This is Jordan, and you're listening to the Code 7 Podcast Network.
Warning. This episode contains the three A's of podcasting: adult content, adult language, and awesomeness. You've been warned.
Welcome to Within the Trenches, true stories from the 911 dispatchers who live them.
Good evening. This is Ricardo with the Code 7 Podcast Network, and this is going to be episode 148 of Within the Trenches. I'm recording live from the Crown Plaza in Lansing, Michigan, for the 2017 Michigan NENA Conference, where it all began, folks. Yep, this is where it was. I'm sitting at the same table where Whitney and I first started doing these episodes for the podcast, and it's always fun to come back here, especially going into the Rio room where my coworker April gave a presentation today on technology and, you know, NG stuff, all this awesome stuff that's coming to 911. But I was in there back in 2013 talking about the podcast, how it all got started, my story, and it has just blown up since then. So it's been excellent. This episode, along with all the others, is supported by InDigital, Elite, our next-gen core services. And make sure to, if you're going out to San Antonio, Texas for the National NENA Conference, to check us out there. It'll be the first time that I'm doing the podcast from the booth. We've got a 20 by 20 booth. We're going to have three different stations going, talking about next-gen core services, text for 911, our Mevo backup phone system, disaster recovery. And we are also going to be it's talking about a project that we're working on with RapidSOS that involves location accuracy for cell phones. Now, there's not a lot I can say about it, but I can tell you this, that I have seen the future of location accuracy. So it's going to be great. So if you get a chance to, make sure to head out there. I'm going to have IM91 decals and a bunch of other stuff available as well. So make sure to check that out. Now, my guest today is a gentleman that I've been talking to for a while now, and we've been trying to get together to do an episode. And I was just telling him before we started that the conversation that we had here at this conference last year would have made an excellent episode. And now, a year later, we're finally going to get to it. So my guest today is Adam Tim, and he's with the Healthy Dispatcher. How's it going, man?
Doing great. Thanks so much for having me, Ricardo.
Yes, finally.
Yeah, absolutely.
After we spoke last year, mm-hmm. I mean, we've just been emailing back and forth, yeah, and Facebook messaging. We're in a group with a bunch of other people. What is it, Dispatch Monkey? You've got Operation 10-8, the 911 Training Institute, the Cool Kids of 911, and Public Safety Dispatchers and Friends. We're all in this group, and it's like a meeting of the minds, really, yeah, a lot, yeah, of times. So yeah, there's right. been a lot of stuff that we've been talking about, a lot going on, and a lot to get to today. So for those who don't know Adam Tim, you know, how did you get started in public safety? Because you're with the Healthy Dispatcher. However, you had humble beginnings. You came from the dispatch center as well.
Yes, absolutely. So the Healthy Dispatcher is my training company. Uh-huh. But before I was a full-time trainer, I spent 10 and a half years at the LAPD, Los Angeles Police Department Communications Division.
Can't even imagine that.
I was one of 500 dispatchers, cross-trained both on call taking and dispatching functions. And we processed 3 million calls for service each year.
What?
So it's very busy, very busy center. And I started in 2003. I was 23 years old. And I can't say that I really knew what to expect.
Right.
I didn't even know that I was signing up to become a 911 dispatcher. In fact, mm-hmm. I knew I was going to be working for the police department, but the title that the LAPD uses for a dispatcher is police service representative. So I knew that I'd be processing calls for police service, but suddenly I'm a 911 operator.
Right, yeah.
And I had all these expectations getting into 911. I'm from small town Minnesota, so mm-hmm. I relocated to LA, and I had an expectation that people would call 911 for only real 911 emergencies, right?
I
had an expectation that I could easily keep the stresses of the job from infiltrating the rest of my life.
Right.
And those expectations were way off. And so I had a tough time in the job. For the first 7 years or so, I really struggled with stress and kind of taking on, for me, it was the non-emergency calls for service that I had the most challenges with. Mm-hmm. Because I felt that the beloved citizens calling in, reporting loud parties, and the neighbor,
I like how you put that.
Neighbor disputes, the ice cream truck is too loud, can you have them move down the streets? I found that they aren't the nicest people. And when you say, I'm sorry, it might be a while before the police get out there, or you say something like, that's not a service that the police provide, and they say, just do your job, I pay your salary.
Yes.
That was a tough thing for me. And so for the first 7 years, I didn't really have the tools to do anything about the harmful effects of stress. And then I kind of hit a wall. And I have the first 7 years up to that point, I have a disciplinary record to show for the challenges that I was experiencing. To boot. And then I took a stress reduction class and I learned a few different tools for resilience, and it really changed my life. And for 3.5 more years, I worked at LAPD. I was a easier person to be around. I was no longer Angry Adam. That's not a nickname I gave myself. Actually, during that last 3 years, at some point, one of my coworkers came up to me and she said, "Adam, I don't know what you did, but you were such an easier person to be around. Back then, we were calling you Angry Adam behind your back." I was appalled to hear that.
Right.
You know, like I'm from small town Minnesota. Midwesterners, if you know Midwesterners, generally are nice people, right? I was not that type of person being Angry Adam. So,
right.
So for 3 more years, I was no longer Angry Adam. I was able to deliver better customer service. I kept my stress level at bay, built my level of resilience, and seeing how my life really transformed using a few simple tools, increasing my self-awareness and emotional intelligence, I thought I have to share this with my coworkers.
Right.
And so I wrote a proposal. It was just a one sheet statement of, I want to do a guided stress reduction class once a week instead of going to roll call training, which was our pre-shift meeting, mm-hmm. Before we relieved the off-going watch, they would allow a group of people who wanted to come to a 15-minute guided breathing session, guided relaxation session. And the lieutenant I turned that proposal into said, "I support you. Anything that will help make life a little bit easier around here, I'll support." And I got the staff psychologist to buy off. I got the captain of the division to buy off on it. And that early program, over 100 of my 911 coworkers came through it. I was teaching it in conjunction with my daily duties.
Right.
And it ran for almost 2 years. And I was like, oh my gosh, this stuff works.
Yeah.
And so that kind of planted the seed for what I wanted to do. I started designing classes around stress reduction. People started to ask me to be a subject matter expert in de-stressing one's life. I actually wrote my first book on this very topic, like seeing how much my life had transformed after kicking my stress habit. That was the title of
destroying.
That was my title of my first book, Stress is Optional, How to Kick the Habit.
Nice. So you destroyed Angry Adam.
Destroyed Angry
Which
Adam.
Which is good.
And started to see a life of possibility that was previously obscured from my view. And about 3 years ago, I left LAPD to do training and speaking full time. And now that's what I do. I'm on the road about 200 days a year with the Healthy Dispatcher, doing APCO, NINA conferences, training classes all at PSAPs all over the country. And I feel very fortunate to be able to serve the 911 industry in this way. Even after I had killed Angry Adam, I was a decent dispatcher, but I think I'm a better presenter. Mm-hmm. My tools or skills are better used helping to motivate and offer some real strategies and ideas for powerful change.
Well, so going back in time a little bit, you said you're You were one out of 500 dispatchers.
Yeah.
So for those listening to kind of picture that, what did the inside of your PSAP or dispatch center, for those who don't know what a PSAP is, your dispatch center, what did that look like? Were you just in a, were you in a cube? Were you able to stand up and just see tons of people? Or, I mean, what exactly was that like? Because all your entire environment, excuse me, and the calls that you were taking, you know, in LA, I mean, all of that had to contribute to the amount of stress and angry Adam, as you were called. So, and I have another question about angry Adam as well, but this first, what exactly did it look like?
So the, we had two dispatch centers, and the staff of 500 were divided up into the 24 hours shifts. So we had 3 8-hour shifts. So the three different shifts, AM watch, PM watch, and day watch. And, on any given shift, you would have between 40 and 60 people in one room. And it was just a massive room with 84 dispatch consoles, each with six screens, and still like 3 foot of space around each console. So you can imagine it's just a massive single room with vaulted ceilings that were about 30 feet high and a skylight up top. And,
so you're like in a hive or something.
It's kind of like a hive.
That's crazy.
Yeah, exactly. And there were Evans consoles that raised and lowered, so you could stand up. But they had it set up so that you still had your space.
Okay.
So you couldn't necessarily, if you listened carefully, you could hear the person processing the call at the console next to you. Mm-hmm. But I think they opened this center in 2001. Prior to that switch, prior to the new centers, they had dispatch in the basement of City Hall, four floors underground.
What?
In this low-ceilinged, carpeted room with this console shoulder to shoulder. I couldn't imagine.
It's like a dungeon, man.
I couldn't. Yeah, it was literally like a dungeon.
No sunlight, no nothing?
Nothing. I couldn't imagine. And there's still some of my coworkers who were working for the LAPD back then, back in those days. I think that there was definitely a shift towards creating an environment that was more conducive to success.
Right.
You know?
Well, so, okay, so angry Adam and the stress that you had, was it simply something mentally, or was it also physically, damning to you? I mean, because stress can do a lot of things, and stress can definitely mess you up physically. Yeah. So were you dealing with that as well during that time?
So at that 7-year mark, I was dogged by all of the attendant effects of chronic stress. So I had daily tension headaches and migraines, ulcers, indigestion. Those are all symptoms of chronic stress. And then as a result of kind of feeling like I had no control, I felt overwhelmed and frustrated. So I was venting my anger and frustration on the callers,
right?
On my coworkers, on my supervisors. I would blame my coworkers for not doing a good job, or I blame my supervisors for gunning for me, completely overlooking the fact that I was giving them ample ammunition
to gun for
me. And I was also a hardcore road rager. I was fighting I was fighting for justice on the LA freeways. And so that it was like, it was mental and physical. It was everything. And I thought that 911 was the sole source of my stress and frustration. But once I started to apply these tools for resilience, some breathing practices, journaling, self-reflection, within 6 months, my life had transformed, but I still had the same 911 job.
Right.
Like, how could that be? Because it was really about the way I was thinking about things. Had a very negative and condescending perspective, and I also had I was nurturing difficult relationships outside of work.
So there are many factors.
So there's many factors, and I think the one thing that I see that's consistent with 911 telecommunicators is that we're heroic caregivers, and we frequently that's not only on the job, but outside, we're the person in our sphere of influence that people come to.
This is true.
To solve your problems, to say, hey, can you help me out with this thing? And we might be helping people and we're in a codependent situation where we're actually hurting both that person we think we're helping and ourselves.
Right.
And so I was in one of those relationships with a business partner and a girlfriend at the time. And I had to divest myself from these difficult relationships as well. So that was all part of this kind of letting go of the old way.
Right.
And suddenly I could breathe again. I could see clearly. I could move in the direction of something inspiring, something that I really wanted to do. And I think that's what led me to sharing these tools with others. And
right.
It really animates what I do now to this day.
So looking back at the time that you were there in the center and, you know, you're dealing with all this stress and all this other crap that's going on, what about some of the calls that you took? Do you remember the first call you ever took? Or
I remember the first call that really got me going. Like I felt the surge of adrenaline and the prickly,
right,
the
yeah.
pins and needles. Yeah. It was, and I think I still had my instructor sitting next to me. It was a man calling from a payphone, 911 on a payphone. Tons of payphones all over in downtown LA. It's free to dial 911. So there's a lot of people who dial 911.
Oh, I bet.
Rightfully or not. And he was reporting that he had just saw, it was down in the Skid Row area of LA. He just saw a man pull a woman into a porta potty to attack her.
Right.
Which is a rape. And mm-hmm. I was like, oh. And I felt that start and I got all the information. And I asked him to stay on the line.
Typing with authority and
yeah,
such.
Yeah, typing with authority, getting suspect information,
yeah.
who, what, where, when, all of that stuff. And the thing with LAPD, because it's such a huge agency,
right.
There's 10,000 officers on the streets. We don't really have, in communications, we don't really have a relationship with the cops on the street. So I followed that call and I know that the police got out there and they dispositioned the call ARR, which is arrest. So I think that my efforts were warranted, but who knows? So that was the first call that really, really got to me.
Mm-hmm.
I had several suicide calls where I kept a teenager on the phone until the police got there. They were contemplating taking their life. Lots of domestic violence. There's shootings every day in Los Angeles. So I've heard gunshots go off in the background. One time I said 911 emergency operator 237. And I just heard someone drop the phone. And then I heard yelling out in the street. And this was in South LA, yelling out in the street. So all I pictured in my mind is that the front door was open and there's yelling and shooting going on in the street, like straight up Training Day stuff.
Oh man.
Yeah. It was insane. And I always felt like those calls, the real emergencies, were my chance to really help. They didn't really, I would say that that is good stress. That was good stress for me. Like I felt on point and getting the information and getting the police out there. It was really the slog through the non-emergency calls day in and day out. I mean, we know the statistics. 70% of all calls are non-emergency.
Yeah.
That was really challenging for me.
And that's crazy to say that, excuse me, that, you know, those were the calls that you really dug, because I've said the same thing.
Really?
If it was a domestic call or a higher priority call, and I always say this, the public wouldn't understand this. And I'm hoping that the amount of people that are listening now understand whenever I say those were the calls that I loved to take.
Yeah.
Not because I was an adrenaline junkie or something, or, you know, I wanted somebody to get hurt. It was because that's where I was able to give my most resources, my most effort. Those are the ones that I felt like I was helping the most.
Yeah.
So like you, it's the same way.
Yeah.
But the non-emergency ones is like,
You're
going to have another person call and it's, yeah. So.
And I think fundamentally it is an inability to relate. So even to this day, I have never called 911 ever in my life.
Really?
Yeah. I've never needed to.
Because you kind of knew what you had to do anyway, right?
Yeah, I mean, I feel blessed. I feel blessed to say that I've never had to call 911. Yet, a typical day in LA, I'm talking to people who are dialing the 911 for non-emergency matters every single day, and there's lack of connection. And I know it was, and our supervisors would tell us, it's not your job to judge them. It's just to take the information, to find a reason to send. That's easier said than done, right?
Right,
to divest yourself from that judgment and all of that.
That is very hard, yes.
Yeah, yeah.
Especially if you're taking a phone call from someone. And so I had, I'm trying to remember exactly how it went. So it was an older lady who called, and she had some people that were staying downstairs in her basement. Mm-hmm. And they had a dog down there. Well, the couple that were down in the basement, they took off for like a week. And she called because she was angry with them because they were not feeding the dog. And I asked her, I said, ma'am, it's your home, correct? And she goes, yeah, they're just paying me to stay here, and they're downstairs. And I said, well, do you have a lock on the door? And she goes, well, no, I can go down there. And I said, well, if the dog is, you know, and that, because she was saying that it was just like yelping and it, you know, it was starving down there. I said, if you're able to just go downstairs whenever you want, you can give the dog food, right? And she goes, oh, yeah. Yeah. But I mean, she was very upset and pissed off and like going at me about it. Mm. And it took me having to kind of slow down and say something to her. But, you know, then because I wasn't a supervisor yet, but my supervisor had said, you know, you could have done something different. Like what? Explaining it to her that way it was like you were being, you know, condescending or something. I thought, well, how else am I supposed to get, you know, that through? So, yeah, that the call's like that.
Yeah. I had a similar call where I gave advice to the caller.
Yeah.
And I was being monitored. And the monitoring supervisor felt that I was being discourteous, and so they cut a complaint sheet on it, and it became a sustained complaint. And the lieutenant, who was a friend of mine, at the time, the assistant watch commander, when he was serving me the complaint, he said, Adam, I listened to the call, and I think that if you want to help people in this way, you should get a different job.
Nice. Yeah.
He called me a life coach. He said, you can't be a life coach. You're not a life coach on the phone lines.
But it's hard, you know? It's hard. Just like with me explaining to the lady, you know, the judgment and, you know, all the other stuff. It's hard not to
try to coach them through the
right, exactly. Because it was such an easy thing where, ma'am, if you're that upset about the dog and the dog is starving down there and you can go downstairs, because I think if I remember correctly, she said the her laundry room was down there as well. So she'd gone down there before. Right. And the dog is there dying, you know, starving and stuff. It's like, just give the dog food. Yeah. You know, you don't have to call and tie up a line, but people don't know. No. They don't understand.
They're not open. You know, they're calling for a specific purpose.
Right.
We want the police to come out here and get someone out here. Mm-hmm. I get it. I mean, it's a tense situation. A lot of people don't call 911 every single day. I would say most people are calling when they're having a really bad day. Mm-hmm. And so it's hard to keep that in perspective, because everyone's bad day is our every day.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yes, definitely. So you ended up working for 10 years.
10 and a half years.
10 and a half years, LAPD, mm-hmm. which I can't even wrap my mind around working there and the amount of calls that you were taking. So how about your overtime and stuff?
Did you overtime at the time.
Really?
Yeah.
So you guys were fully staffed, or
we were staffed enough to not mandate overtime.
And then if somebody called in, it didn't matter.
They would have to staff for that. On some days there were like over 12, 14 people who would call in sick.
Jeez.
So
and you still had enough. That's crazy.
I think that they were willing to let the call service levels drop on non-emergency. So on any given day, you're either on 911 or non-emergency. So oh, if you're okay. So it's for the entire shift. Well. So okay. if you, yeah, so it's the, you're either a dispatcher, a 911 operator, or a non-emergency operator for the entire shift. Mm-hmm. Cross, we're all cross-trained identically. And so if you're a non-emergency operator, you're taking non-emergency calls all day long. You are the whipping child for the citizens of LA.
Oh,
that
man.
Might be a bad way of looking at it, but because they're not calling to wish you a happy day.
Right, exactly.
And so they were willing to go down to minimum staffing levels and just let those calls hold because they're not emergencies. So they would staff enough 911 call takers to meet that federal mandate, the 10 all calls, 90% of calls by 10 seconds.
Gotcha.
And then the dispatching, you still needed a minimum. So there are 23 divisions in the city plus 4 traffic divisions. So 27 radio frequencies. So you need 27 dispatchers.
Right.
Every shift.
Oh man.
on top of 20 to 30 call takers each shift. So see, that's kind of how the operation works.
I would much rather be taking all of the either being on radios or all the emergency calls versus I've got an alarm. Got an alarm, or I've got this or that, or
neighbor dispute.
Yeah, neighbor dispute.
Neighbor threw trash on my lawn.
Yeah,
my neighbor kids are playing ball on the street.
You know, I actually okay. So we're talking going back to talk about the domestics and stuff that I enjoyed taking. There was these two guys that lived together. To me, they were the equivalent of Walter Matthau and Jack Lemmon as
grumpy old men.
Yes, grumpy old men, man, and. One of them would call, and mostly they would fight over the TV remote. And they'd call in and said, "So-and-so is it? I was watching this show. I told him I was going to watch it. I got up to go get some cereal. I came back, and he's got the remote. He won't give it back to me." I'm like, "All right." And I'm going through the motions, of course, because anything could happen.
Yeah.
And I would always ask, "Is there any weapons involved?" Well. I mean, we've got, knives and stuff, so something could happen. And so because the something could happen, of course I'm putting that in the narrative. So they've got to go somewhat lights and sirens to get over there. Mm-hmm. And I'd say, has anybody been hurt or anything? Well, he hit me with a pillow. All right. Subject says that he's been hit with a pillow and
viciously struck with
right,
a pillow.
Yeah, exactly. And this would happen every time with these two guys. Wow. It was either the remote or someone finished the cereal, and it was stuff like that. And those were kind of the fun domestics because they were just two old dudes. I mean, they could have had their own TV show.
Sure.
and one of the episodes could have been, me taking their ridiculous call.
Yeah.
But even thinking that it was ridiculous, anything could have happened. The other guy could have ended up getting, pissed off and hit him over the head with a bowl or something.
Yeah, definitely.
Choke him with the Cheerio box.
So you were fine. Even in that instance, you're trying to find a reason to send the police.
Right.
For a higher priority call.
Exactly. Yeah.
I think it's really important to keep a sense of humor. Like mm-hmm. you said, that's a fun thing. When you're 80 calls deep into a shift, it's not as easy to retain that sense of humor.
Well, like I said, I keep saying, I can't imagine working like that nonstop and taking that many calls. I mean, ever since I started doing the podcast and blogging and everything, I've always talked about how, I would take a call and then jump right into the next one. But you're taking a call, jumping into the next one, and I don't even know how you were able to breathe. I mean, how did you guys even schedule going to the bathroom?
There's a break schedule.
Oh, okay. So you got a schedule then.
Yeah, there's three different or five different break schedules, and so people would rotate through the break schedules. So we had lunches, we had 15-minute scheduled breaks that the union really fought for. I think that's one thing about the large agencies. Especially, and I can only really speak educatedly about California PSAPs, really good about scheduling break time and being in accordance with the FLSA all of that stuff. So they're not, you can't work, you at the time you couldn't work past 8 hours. They're doing compressed work schedules now. So they've got some 10 and 12 hour shifts going on. But when I was working there, it was 8 hours only. We had breaks. And even now with the compressed work schedule, they still have scheduled breaks. And that's how the machine really works. And I think another thing about large PSAPs is while they still grapple with morale and turnover, they know that they have to keep their staffing levels up.
Right.
Because the citizens, there's only becoming more citizens. Only more people are moving to Southern California.
Yeah.
So you gotta, if
you don't die, we multiply.
Yeah, exactly.
It just keeps going on and going on.
Yeah.
So then those 10 and a half years, you decide, well, what was the actual moment? Was it when you took that class that it really, and you kind of turned things around, that's when you realized that you wanted to go off and do what you're doing now? Or what was that moment?
So there was a moment, it was actually the application of the tools that I was learning. So it was a 6 week stress reduction class, and I learned simple breathing practices to decrease my stress. I did some really introspective journaling work, meditation work, really self reflection, and kind of rewriting my personal story. We have a choice of looking back on our life, and we can tell a story of heartbreak and sorrow, and I was never given anything, and I was like those other people have it so much better because listen to my story.
Yeah.
There's nothing wrong with that.
Right.
We can also tell a story of triumph and overcoming challenges and obstacles and wins, and it's really in how you tell your story. We can at any time rewrite that story and tell it in a different way. And it really changes things. It changes by retelling the past. We can change the present and our future trajectory. And so during this class, I was kind of like looking back on the way that I was telling my childhood story and my relationship with my parents and my family. And I reconciled with it. And I was like, oh my gosh, I've lived an amazing life. And I want to help in an authentic way. And so in that 6 weeks, I also shed some of those old relationships, and all of a sudden I had so much more space and time, and I wanted to share that. I knew that I'm just me. I knew that it could impact others in the same way, and that's why I wrote that proposal.
Yeah.
I didn't realize that it would really work. It was
right.
Like just going out on faith.
Right,
like,
exactly. I mean, you got to try something, right?
I wanted to share this, and let's see what happens. And people were just sitting for 15 minutes once a week. I have some of my coworkers say that their children would say, "Mommy, you look so much more happy. You seem much more relaxed." Some people used the space provided by the relaxation to make some changes in their own lives, similar to what I had done. And so to further share that message, I wrote my book to allow it to get out there in a bigger way. So it was like there were these little steps that I was taking. It started off when I did the personal work and my life transformed. Then I was like, I think others could use this because it changed everything. I mean, I'm so much happier. And so I saw that was true as well. How else can I get the message? So I wrote a book about it. And then people started to ask me if I would present for their training classes. And I was also in the background, I was doing Toastmasters. Have you heard of Toastmasters?
I think so.
Toastmasters is an organization built around helping people become better public speakers.
Okay.
It's an international organization.
Uh-huh.
And so I signed up for a Toastmasters club, and I started going once a week practicing standing up in front of a room of people and talking to them. And so, like, all of these pathways were leading me forward into who knows where at the time.
Yeah.
But I became a better presenter. I started working on creating my own classes. And then I started doing free speaking engagements to share this stress reduction, this life of less stress message, and just trying to reach as many people as possible.
You really jumped in.
Yeah. For 3 years, from the last 3 years of my dispatch career, I was speaking, writing, doing the program at 911, doing other trainings outside of my daily work, and more and more people were asking me. And then I got my first real invitation for like a paid speaking gig. Before any of this, I didn't even realize there was a speaking industry.
Right.
That,
yeah.
That you could get paid to go somewhere.
Exactly.
And share information and get compensated for that. So I was still working for LAPD, and the first big contract was like $2,000 for 4 hours. And I was like, oh my gosh.
Heck yeah.
Yeah, this would be great. And it was for a early childhood program at a college in New Mexico. And I started to like believe in this manifesting path, the reality of what was coming true. And so that's when I left LAPD, was to become an entrepreneur, to speak and train full time. And then I came back to the 911 space. Mm-hmm. I started doing breakout sessions. I think my first breakout sessions for 911 were at the APCO Western Regional Conference.
Oh, okay.
In 2015. Uh-huh. And saw how the dispatchers really...
Which one was that one at?
Sacramento.
No way.
Yeah.
I was there.
No way.
Yeah. Oh, man. Yeah, I was there for... Well, I was working the vendor hall there, of course, and I was supposed to give a text for 911 presentation.
Oh, wow.
In the vendor hall, on stage and everything, and there was no one there.
Oh.
Well, so the person who set it up set it up at noon when there are no attendees there because they're all out at lunch, so it's all vendors.
Oh.
So we didn't end up giving – I didn't give the talk. Only one guy showed up, who was also a vendor.
Gotcha.
But it ended up turning out really well because we were trying to do some stuff with language translations. But that's funny that you were there.
Yeah.
See, man, it had all started. It all comes around.
Go ahead.
So you were there. Yeah. You gave your talk there.
Your first series of talks there, breakout sessions.
And that was on the stress reduction and stuff, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So I can't remember what the name of the breakout session was back then. But since then, things have really picked up because there's a real need. And I think it's more about, there's a consciousness shift happening in 911 where the administrators, the managers, mm-hmm. the directors, the supervisors are seeing that we need to value our employees. We need to make work life worth living.
Right.
Especially when we're forcing overtime, especially when we're asking people to give their lives. That's really what you're asking people who work for a company, whether it's a PSAP or IBM.
Right.
When you're asking someone to give their lives to this thing, wouldn't you want them to want to work there, want to come into the job? And yeah, there's an inherent value in the work that is done in 911. You know, I think that I would argue that that's why a lot of 911 telecommunicators continue to come in each day, even though they're grappling with minimal staffing and all of the challenges, is because they are really making a difference.
Right.
Like, that's what IM911 is all about, right? It's like seeing this tangible evidence of how we're making a difference. And I love that more PSAPs are prioritizing training and education. In my research, I find that the best PSAPs prioritize training and education. They're always training their folks. They're always, they are prioritizing budget. They are, like, it is so, so important.
Right.
Because they know that trained staff stay inspired longer. They provide better customer service. They have more fun, you know. And so I feel like that's kind of what the 911 training community, and I'm only one of many fantastic trainers that are out there right now. But I think that's what we're part of. We're part of ushering this kind of this change of consciousness of how do we better value and show our employees, the frontline telecommunicators, the line supervisors, all the way through the organization, how do we show them that they really are making a difference? And how do we allow them to sustain that effort over the long haul?
Right. And I fully agree, man, because when this whole thing started, I mean, that's kind of what I wanted to do some sort of, which what turned into the I Am 911 movement. And it just happened to also fit with this whole reclassification thing. Mm-hmm. You know, the underlying thing here, or, well, really the main thing was what people were saying, you know, identify them as being part of the protective class. I saw it as, you know, finally give us some respect. Notice that we do way more than what you think. So by telling these horrific stories to open the eyes, you know, make people aware of what, you know, dispatchers are doing, you know, the types of calls that they're taking, the stress, that whole, you know, a different, you know, consciousness, like you're saying, it really started to come out. And I keep telling people the reclassification thing is important, but there's way more to that whole thing than people know about. But the movement ended up turning into something much bigger than that, because I mean, news stories, I've only seen a handful of news stories where they're talking bad about dispatch since all of this started. There have been more news stories about dispatchers under stress, you know, the types of calls that they're taking, or honoring those, you know, dispatcher of the year. There was a lot of times where you didn't see shit like that. You didn't see that on the news. And they're showing that stuff on the news. They're showing it online and in newspapers. There's all this other stuff that's, you know, showing dispatchers in a different light and a good light.
It's huge.
And it's, it's been amazing. And, you know, you and like you said, you're one of many other, you know, great trainers and stuff. You guys are now able to help them because they're also realizing themselves. I mean, there were people that were sending in, you know, emails and stuff saying, I didn't realize this really affected me that much, you know, at the time until I started writing out these stories, you know, and luckily, you know, they're able to do it anonymously. And that was a big thing too, because people didn't want to, they didn't want to share. And I made sure to put it out there. I won't reveal who you are. You just tell me your story in this certain way, and you know, we'll get it out there for you. And so people were becoming self-aware of their own, you know, stressors and how they needed to be more healthy. And you know, dispatch centers and the directors, you know, sending me emails saying, you know, this is good because we're going to use a lot of these stories to go to, you know, county commissioners or whatever to say we need more money for training. We need to do more for the wellness, the well-being of our dispatchers, because if they're not getting that, something, you know, bad could happen. If you've got a dispatcher that's completely stressed out, pissed off, that person who's calling in for help, you never know. Something could, they could miss something, or they could treat that person like shit, you know, anything could happen.
Well, I found it so interesting that, that in fantastic training, like the hiring, recruitment, and training process at some of the largest PSAPs, this training process can take over a year to get them all trained up. And they don't even talk about, and if they do talk about stress management and the impact of stress and the importance of building resilience, it might be a two-hour block out of weeks and weeks of training.
Jeez.
That's kind of part of my mission is to increase the awareness of, first of all, the impact of stress, and also the fact that there are ways around it. We can, if we equip our dispatchers as they go into the profession, to mitigate the harmful effects of stress and to be aware of what it feels like to be under duress, the body stressed out. And then they can use these little tools or they can ask to step away. And then that starts to change the way that we staff 911 centers so that people actually can have breaks. And you'll those listening who work in small PSAPs where you got one person working an entire shift and they're tethered to their console, even when they have to use the bathroom.
Yes.
I really take issue with that because, first of all, it's no one should be forced to work in that environment. Second of all, it's always about the money, right? Yet there are municipalities all over the country aren't wisely spending, first of all, dollars allocated specifically to 911. Second of all, dollars at the city level. When you think that the service that really is the lifeblood of our municipalities, the 911 system,
right,
is not getting the attention that it requires, deserves, needs. It's crazy.
It is. Yeah, it's alarming. You know, you would think that a lot of, you know, money that comes in and stuff would go to new equipment or, you know, continued education, you know, training for stress. It doesn't.
Yeah.
At least not always. And
no.
It always makes me wonder. But I'm not in that area anymore.
Right.
But it also, you know, makes me feel bad for those that are still in there,
yeah,
that are dealing with this, yeah, because they themselves probably don't know everything that's going on in the background.
Right.
You know, how come we don't get to go to training? How come we don't get to go to conferences? So case in point, I posted something the other day on the Facebook fan page for the podcast, and I had asked, you know, how many of you are going to the national conference in Texas? And I think out of all the people, there was maybe two or three, and all the others said, our dispatch center, they don't allow us to go to stuff like that. Mm. Others said, only the supervisors get to go and they bring information back. And, you know, well, others just can't afford it, so they don't ever send anybody. And that sucks.
Yeah.
There's a lot that comes out of these conferences. It's, of course, you know, it's a lot of fun too, you know, but the networking and the amount of classes and stuff that you can learn,
yeah,
it's very important. And yeah, but
one thing that I consistently hear in my training classes is, because I put people together and they share their stories,
yes,
with each other, almost always someone says it feels good to know that I'm not alone.
Yeah.
That we're
Isn't that
all
amazing?
That so many of us are experiencing the same challenges.
Right.
And I think that's what Conference Land is all about, mm-hmm, and networking and reaching outside of your PSAP, and seeing what else is, seeing how others are doing the work and what other people are grappling with. Like, that's a huge thing to feel like you have allies.
Right. Yes. Yeah. That thin gold line. Yeah.
Yeah. Love that.
Exactly.
I love it.
Well, so then, oh man, when was it? Was it this past fall? We were in Colorado. We were in Denver.
Yeah.
And
October.
Was it October?
Yep.
So I was in that class that you had given, and you did. You did that in the beginning. You had everyone turn to the person to your left or however, yeah, and introduce yourself and you know, tell a story.
Yeah.
And you know, the girl next to me, you know, we're talking and stuff and we're laughing and it got real loud in there too. Real fast.
Yeah.
And but that was cool to be able to talk about that.
Yeah.
And I think she was the one who ended up, because I said, I'm not a dispatcher anymore. And she's like, well, once a dispatch, always dispatch. And I was like, yeah, hell yeah, you're right. Yeah, once and always. But yeah, that's a very good thing, because you never want to feel alone. And a lot of people that were writing in messages too were kind of the same way, you know, mm-hmm, saying, you know, I've read through all of these stories and I thought I was the only one dealing with this.
Yeah.
Or when I first started putting out episodes, people had written in saying the same thing. Mm-hmm. There was one girl that I remember specifically who said, I'm real happy, you know, listening to these episodes because I'm 6 months into training and I didn't think I was going to make it. I was getting ready to quit, but I'm not the only one who's going through stuff like this. I mm-hmm. thought it was just me and nobody is really talking to me. And I remember being there in the beginning of my dispatch career where I was training and nobody else talked to me.
Yeah.
And then, you know, finally the trainer said, well, they're not supposed to talk to you. You're supposed to be paying attention to me. And I said, I know, but it just, I understand why you guys are doing it, because you want me to concentrate and, you know, do what you're doing or whatever. But if I don't feel like I'm part of a team already, why am I even going to be here?
Right.
You know, I remember telling my wife a lot, you know, I don't think I could do this. I think I'm going to quit. And she would ask me why. And I would tell her, it's like, it's not even like a team. It's just me and my trainer. And, you know, they're talking to each other, but, you know, kind of include me as well. I know there's not a lot I can do, but, you know, talk to me like I'm there, you know, like I'm part of the team. So I want to be there.
Yeah.
And I stuck it out either way, of course, 13 and a half years. But, you know, it was that feeling alone in the whole training and in the beginning that I was like, man, F this. I'm not going to do this because these people don't care.
Yeah.
But it turned around. So I can completely understand what you're saying by, you know, them saying I'm not alone.
Yeah.
So you said you were doing some research, and so with the research that you're doing, does that also, you know, go into some of the classes that you put together, or
definitely.
Does it come off of those classes, or
doing a session tomorrow called One Common Goal,
right?
People-Oriented PSAP Leadership, which I share stories from the research that I'm doing. So I'm writing my third book right now, and it's on the kind of the challenges that most PSAPs are facing right now, the staffing challenges, the turnover, the low trainee success rate. I mean, some centers are having only 40% to 50% of their new trainees get through the training program. And then that just perpetuates the staffing challenges, negativity in the workplace, all of these perennial problems that plague our PSAPs.
Yeah.
I'm really curious about those who have led successful positive change initiatives and have overcome these very challenges. And so I've been collecting stories. I've done about, at this point, 15 case study interviews with directors and managers who have successfully led these positive change initiatives. And I have stories of centers who have dropped their turnover to zero, that have 100% training success 3 years after they start. Centers that have gone from minimal staffing and in 1 year with bold and decisive action have gone to full staffing and then getting two more bodies because the county board said, if you get fully staffed, we'll give you two more budget for two more people. So they go from minimal staffing and in 1 year to changing. Like, how do they rewrite the script like this? I'm very curious about that. And so those stories go into my breakout sessions. Of course, when the book is done, it's going to be a great resource for those who are looking to make powerful, positive change at their centers.
Dude, it's almost like a fantasy.
I know.
to hear that.
It's like a unicorn.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. That is definitely a unicorn of public safety.
I know.
To have, you know, the turnover rate to be like that, because
and I've heard it more than once.
Really?
Yeah. There was one center in Texas. The year before, it took them about 4 years for the efforts that they were making, the changes they were making, to gain traction. And the year one, they had turnover of 21%. Year two, they had turnover of 37%. Year three, they had turnover of 32%. Year four, 0%.
Whoa.
Because their efforts took root.
Right.
They changed their culture. They changed the environment. They changed the way that people worked with each other and spoke to each other.
See, and that's a big thing right there, working with each other and speaking to each other, because people, if you don't know, in dispatch land, and from what I've been told, which makes me laugh all the time, we eat our own young.
Yeah. Yeah. I hate that phrase.
I know, exactly. But you hear it all the time.
Of course.
For whatever
reason. There's classes at conferences. Stop eating your young or something like that.
Right. Yeah. I think I've seen that before. Yeah. And I don't know what it is that you get people that come in, good people, and they want to be there and they want to work, yet I don't know if it's like a hazing or initiation type bullshit that happens. And then, you know, you get someone who wants to be there and work hard and do you know, good. And then, you know, people are just dicks. And, yeah. And then they're gone.
It's this rite of initiation.
Yeah.
Kind of thing. And I believe that it's more about programming. Mm-hmm. Like, this is how I was brought into the organization. And so this is how I'm going to bring others into the organization. It's just like how we model our parents' behavior when it comes to parenting.
Yeah.
Like, we say, I'm never going to be like my dad. And then when we have kids, we end up disciplining our kids just like our dad. And we didn't like that. You know, like, why? Like, all of a sudden, we're doing what we said we would never do.
That is so true. Because there have been a couple times where I've been talking to my 13-year-old, and I see the look on his face. And have you ever seen the movie Ratatouille?
Yes.
Okay. When at the end of the movie, when the critic eats the food and flashbacks to him being a kid.
Yes.
That is the exact same flashback that I have. And it's me looking up at my dad and him telling me whatever it is that I was saying. Yeah. And then I come back like, oh my God. and I'm standing there and, you know, Logan will say, what? I'm like, let's start all over. let me tell you a different way of how you shouldn't have done that. But then, yeah. So exactly. Yeah, it's the same thing, just like your parents. You don't want to do it. But the person who brought you up in your training, that's what you end up doing as well. Because I know some of the, when I first started there in Allegan, you know, a couple of the people had been there, the seasoned dispatchers, that said, you know, something similar. Like, well, this is how we did it. And this is how it is. And, you know, and it just continues on. But at one point, you know, somebody's got to break the cycle.
Right.
You know, it's something has got to get shifted. Yep. You got to change, and so we have to not eat our young.
Exactly. In my research, what I found is that it is bold and decisive leadership action that causes that state change, and it takes a courageous leader to say something as audacious as, "We are not going to tolerate negativity in this workplace." In this PSAP, if you're going to be negative, you should find somewhere else to work, and actually discipline according to that principle.
Yes,
because there's one thing in saying, you know, it sucks around here, and that's just the implicit and explicit message that, and I see so many classes around mixing negativity, and like, how do we end up in this place anyway? Well, it's often just drift. The nature of the work that we do is negative. People aren't calling to wish you a happy day.
Right.
and then you've got, there's little control. So the frontline telecommunicator, I mean, let's face it, all the way up and down the organization, we sometimes have very little control over the way work is done.
Right.
Plus we have to live through a specific role. When someone snaps at you, when a citizen snaps at you on the phone, you can't be Ricardo and like how you would really talk to someone who just treated you like that. You have to be a telecommunicator Martinez, who is courteous. And that is stressful, working through those roles, suppressing our natural urges, and then listening to all of this stuff. And in time, it creates an environment that is, it doesn't have to be negative, but it's a low energy.
Right, yeah.
Right?
And it brings down morale as well.
Exactly. And so it takes daily reminders saying, hey, I know that was a tough call. We're all in this together. We're working with it together. One director out in Colorado, she and her team, she involved everyone in this effort, put together a mission statement and a values statement, and they then posted those values on the wall in the dispatch center. They put it on their annual statement that they put out for the comm center. The comm center put out an annual statement with goals, and then they designed a disciplinary policy around adhering to these values: respect, integrity, teamwork. And when someone was not being respectful, that was a conversation. So you've empowered your line supervisors then to have a conversation saying, hey, notice this conversation. Is everything okay?
Right.
But that's the entry level to progressive discipline. So from then they start writing paperwork, from then they start having like more strict or a little bit harsher conversations.
Right.
And they actually had to push negative people out of the center. And I've told that story to a room at a conference. And they're like, well, we have union. You can't get rid of union employees. This center has a union as well. And I said to the director, I said, what do you tell people who say you can't, it's so hard to get rid of negative people, especially when you work for a union shop? She said, Adam, the union works for the employees. And I've demonstrated that all of the employees want a workplace that they want and like to come into each day. And so the union got on their side in helping eliminate that negative employee. So there's no reason. Ultimately, the only reason to not like police negativity in a real fashion are the excuses that we make. You know, it's always been this way, and also it's tough. It's tough for. And I've also heard from other supervisors, other leaders in my classes, and they say, you know, why does it all always fall on the leadership? Like, what if we're doing everything that we can do, and people are still saying, hey, this place still sucks to work for?
Right.
It's not. No one ever said leadership would be easy. It isn't easy.
Right.
And unfortunately, sometimes supervisors promote because it's about the money, because they don't have to take calls anymore. However, the best supervisors, the best leaders, the best managers are always willing to hop on, to put on a headset and work a frequency. That's why they're the best. They walk the walk.
Right. Exactly.
You know, so there's all these things. It's fascinating to me. I'm super curious about what the best.
I can't wait for this to come out, man. Yeah. This is good stuff.
Yeah.
So where do you go from here, man? I mean, you're here in Michigan. You've got these classes and everything that you're teaching. I don't know when you sleep. I mean, people say the same thing to me, and I don't really sleep a lot. But you are everywhere.
Yeah.
But I can say with complete confidence that you really are passionate about what you do. I mean, you're so high energy, and when you're talking up there, like I said, I've been in your class, so I know.
Yeah.
But just seeing you talking with people around here as well, you're really, really into it. So I'm
I love it. Just doing more training. Mm-hmm. Last year was a big year for the Healthy Dispatcher, kind of a breakout year. I was on the road, traveled about 70,000 miles in the air last year.
Jeez.
and that's just working conferences, 911 conferences, APCO and NITA conferences, and working with the PSAPs all around the country. This year is where I'm on course to do the same, if not more. And we haven't even really touched the East Coast. So there's more PSAPs to reach. And so the training is a component of that. Also doing more keynotes, conference sessions, and also moving into consulting. But the people side. So there's a lot of, we see in the vendor halls, there's a lot of consulting companies on the technology side.
Right.
And the CAD system side, and entertaining consolidation. I'm the Healthy Dispatcher is about helping PSAP leadership mentor and coach their leaders to become the type of leaders that can create a work environment that employees want to work for. Doing trainings and coaching and mentoring along those lines is what the Healthy Dispatcher Consulting looks like as well.
Nice. And you were doing, you did an online training class as well.
I did for 911CEU.com.
So that one, from what Tom was telling me, you know, that one is like right up there on the top of, you know, people downloading and learning from. Great. Are you looking to do more stuff like that online, or is it more face to face?
I think it's best face-to-face.
Like I said, the high energy,
it's a motivational experience.
Yeah.
And I know that there's a need for low-cost online training options. I think that is something that I'm I'm entertaining, but I do believe that the online training is not as effective as a learning experience.
Right.
I'm curious about designing an online experience, learning experience that would be as effective. It wouldn't be the same as
some Oculus Rift type thing, right?
It wouldn't be the same as being in a breakout session
right,
or
yeah,
one of
yeah.
my 8-hour training classes. But it still could usher in a behavior change, and that's really what I'm passionate about. Mm-hmm. Is do people, after being in one of my sessions, do people feel like they have the tools, perspective, strategies, something that they can use in their life today? Did they connect with their some aspect of their life with the message? And if the answer to that question is yes for everyone in the room, I feel like I've done my job. But that's what animates my actions. It's like I really want those who love this job to be able to thrive into retirement. Because it doesn't take long to, after talking with a 911 telecommunicator, to find out how many minutes, days, months they have left to retirement.
That is very true.
Right?
Yeah.
You know, we're working to retirement, but the unfortunate and sad truth of the matter is that this job is unforgiving. And if you don't have the tools to kind of ride the wave, to prioritize your self-care, and even know what that looks like, chances are very good. Actually, it's very highly unlikely that you will retire in this profession. But I'm trying to change that.
That's awesome, man. Yeah. Well, going into the wrap-up of this episode, because we just went over an hour, I think we could talk way, way more.
It's a great conversation.
Yeah, I know. We're going to have to do this again for sure. And you're going
to
be at Nationals, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, so you're going to be at National, Nina. Are you going to be... you don't have a booth set up or anything, right?
No.
You're doing breakout sessions.
Doing a breakout session.
How many do you have going on there?
Just one at National, Nina. But I'm doing two at APCO in Denver.
Nice.
Yeah.
Sweet. So I'm going to see you twice.
Love it.
And I'm going to be doing the podcast there as well. It'll be the first time that I ever do the podcast at National APCO.
Wow.
Well, mainly because this time we've got a 20x20 booth. We've got three stations. And, well, like I said at the beginning, there's a spot that I have within that 20x20 where I'm going to be doing the podcast. So, yeah, that'll be the first time that I'm doing it at APCO. So we'll be able to record, if you have time, of course, an episode in San Antonio and one in Denver, and we can continue this conversation because this is a good one.
Pick up where we left off.
Exactly. And it's stuff that people need to hear. They need to, you know, they need to be self-aware. They need to look at themselves and say, why am I feeling like this? You know, what is really stressing me out and how can I switch this? Because when I hit my 7-year mark, dude, I was done, man. I was burnt out. Well, I was more of like my 6.5 going into 7. I was burnt out.
Yeah.
And all I wanted to do was to be able to do everything that I could, not only at my job, my family, or with family that lived in the county, because I worked in the county that I grew up in. But I mean, like the public, do everything I could for the public, those who are on the road, and then for myself at home. Mm-hmm. And my family, because I was an asshole coming home from work and, you know, talking with my wife. Mm-hmm. And, you know, at a certain time, we were just like roommates.
Yeah.
We weren't really talking or anything because I was working so much. And I didn't know how to turn off work.
Yeah.
I didn't know how to, you know, relax. And, you know, I wanted to play with my kids and stuff, and I would, but it was different. Mm-hmm. You know, I was there, but I was not really there because I was that stressed out.
Yeah, exactly.
But then when I started, you know, my blog and writing and doing different projects with 911, that's when I found my passion again. And believe it or not, I was less stressed. By that time, I already got high blood pressure and acid reflux and everything else medically wrong that I still deal with today. But I was able to find that way to, you know, to get out of that. So with you and everyone else who is doing, you know, different trainings and stuff, and people listening to an episode like this, they can learn from it. And that's definitely what people need to get out of this whole not being stressed. And hopefully get past that, you know, stigma of if you ask more to talk about, my friend.
Love it.
So how do people find you on social media, or if they want to shoot you an email or whatever, how do they find you?
Yeah, so anyone can send me an email at adam@thehealthydispatcher.com. And that's my website for whoever wants to learn more about our training classes and keynote sessions, thehealthydispatcher.com. And I'm on Facebook. I've got a business page. And I'm retweeting some Within the Trenches podcast and other pertinent information of what's going on in 911. And that's, I think it's facebook.com/thehealthydispatcher. I've got a Twitter @healthydispatch and something else out there. Oh, the other thing that I'm excited about is on LinkedIn. I write articles like every other month or so.
And yes, you do. Yeah, you got a bunch of stuff on there.
My dispatcher burnout article hit almost 70,000 views. So there's a need for this information out there.
Right,
so
exactly.
I write extensively on PSAP leadership and preventing burnout at the center. And that's on LinkedIn. So you can find me, Adam Tim, the Healthy Dispatcher on LinkedIn, and connect with me.
Perfect. All right. Well, thank you again for being on this episode. Like I said in the beginning, it was a long time coming. Finally, we got an episode in, and we're going to get many more because there's a lot more to talk about.
Yeah.
So for those who are listening, if you have any comments, questions, or you want to be a guest on the show, you can email us, and that's going to be wttpodcast@gmail.com. You can follow us on Twitter. That's @911podcast. And you can like us on Facebook. That's facebook.com/withinthetrenchespodcast. And this episode, along with all the other episodes, are supported by InDigital, a leader in next-gen core services. And again, this episode and all the others can be heard on iTunes, Stitcher Radio, SoundCloud, Google Play Music, iHeartRadio, and thejabberlog.com. Have a good one, everybody.
You just listened to a Code 7 Network podcast. If you have any questions or would like to be a guest on the show, send an email to wttpodcast@gmail.com.